seven kingdoms from one end to the other. He'd feasted and wenched and fought in 100 battles. They said it was Donal Noy who forged King Robert's warhammer, the one that crushed the life out of Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident. He'd done all the things that Jon would never do. And then, when he was old, well past 30, he'd taken a glancing blow from an axe, and the wound had festered until the whole arm had to come off. Only then, crippled, had Donal Noy come to the wall, when his life was all but over.
"Yes, life," Noy said. "A long life, or a short one. It's up to you, Snow. The road you're walking, one of your brothers will slit your throat for you one night."
"They're not my brothers," Jon snapped. "They hate me, because I'm better than they are."
"No, they hate you because you act like you're better than they are. They look at you and they see a castle-bred bastard who thinks he's a lordling."
The armourer leaned close.
"You're no lordling. Remember that. You're a Snow, not a Stark. You're a bastard and a bully."
"A bully?" Jon almost choked on the word. The accusation was so unjust it took his breath away. "They were the ones who came after me, four of them.
Four that you've humiliated in the yard. Four who are probably afraid of you. I've watched you fight. It's not training with you. Put a good edge on your sword, and they'd be dead meat. You know it, I know it, they know it. You leave them nothing, you shame them. Does that make you proud?"
Jon hesitated. He did feel proud when he won. Why shouldn't he? But the armourer was taking that away too, making it sound as if he were doing something wrong. "They're all older than me," he said defensively.
"Older and bigger and stronger, that's the truth. I'll wager your master-at-arms taught you how to fight bigger men at Winterfell, though. Who was he? Some old knight?"
"Sir Roderick Cassel," Jon said wearily. There was a trap here. He felt it closing around him. Donal Noy leaned forward into John's face.
"Now think on this, boy. None of these others have ever had a master-at-arms until Sir Alistair. Their fathers were farmers and wagon men and poachers, smiths and miners, and oars on a trading galley. What they know of fighting, they learned between the decks, in the alleys of Old Town and Lannisport, in wayside brothels and taverns on the King's Road. They may have clacked a few sticks together before they came here, but I promise you, not one in 20 was ever rich enough to own a real sword."
His look was grim.
"So how do you like the taste of your victories now, Lord Snow?"
"Don't call me that," Jon said sharply, but the force had gone out of his anger. Suddenly, he felt ashamed and guilty. I didn't think...
"Best you start thinking," Noy warned him. "That, or sleep with a dagger by your bed. Now, go."
By the time Jon left the armory, it was almost midday. The sun had broken through the clouds. He turned his back on it and lifted his eyes to the wall, blazing blue and crystalline in the sunlight. Even after all these weeks, the sight of it still gave him the shivers. Centuries of wind-blown dirt had pocked and scoured it, covering it like a film, and it often seemed a pale grey, the colour of an overcast sky. But when the sun caught it, fair on a bright day, it shone, alive with light, a colossal blue-white cliff that filled up half the sky. "The largest structure ever built by the hands of man," Benjen Stark had told Jon on the King's Road when they had first caught sight of the wall in the distance.
"And beyond a doubt, the most useless," Tyrion Lannister had added with a grin.
But even the imp grew silent when they rode closer. You could see it from miles off, a pale blue line across the northern horizon, stretching away to the east and west and vanishing in the far distance, immense and unbroken. "This is the end of the world," it seemed to say. When they finally spied Castle Black, its timbered keeps and stone towers looked like nothing more than a handful of toy blocks scattered on the snow, beneath the vast wall of ice. The ancient stronghold of the Black Brothers was no Winterfell, no true castle at all. Lacking walls, it could not be defended, not from the south or east or west, but it was only the north that concerned the Night's Watch, and to the north loomed the Wall. Almost 700 feet high it stood, three times the height of the tallest tower in the stronghold it sheltered. His uncle said the top was wide enough for a dozen armored knights to ride abreast. The gaunt outline of huge catapults and monstrous wooden cranes stood sentry up there like the skeletons of great birds, and among them walked men in black, as small as ants. As he stood outside the armory looking up, John felt almost as overwhelmed as he had that day on the King's Road when he had seen it for the first time. The wall was like that. Sometimes he could almost forget that it was there, the way you forget about the sky or the earth underfoot, but there were other times when it seemed as if there was nothing else in the world. It was older than the Seven Kingdoms, and when he stood beneath it and looked up, it made John dizzy. He could feel the great weight of all that ice pressing down on him, as if it were about to topple, and somehow John knew that if it fell, the world fell with it.
"Makes you wonder what lies beyond," a familiar voice said.
John looked round. "Lannister, I didn't see... I mean, I thought I was alone." Tyrion Lannister was bundled in fur so thickly he looked very like a small bear.
"There's much to be said for taking people unawares. You never know what you might learn."
"You won't learn anything from me," John told him. He had seen little of the dwarf since their journey ended. As the Queen's own brother, Tyrion Lannister had been an honoured guest of the Night's Watch. The Lord Commander had given him rooms in the King's Tower, so called, although no king had visited it for 100 years. And Lannister dined at Mormont's own table and spent his days riding the wall and his nights dicing and drinking with Sir Alistair and Bowen March and the other high officers.
"Oh, I learn things everywhere I go,"
the little man gestured up at the wall with a gnarled black walking stick.
"As I was saying, why is it that when a man builds a wall, the next man immediately needs to know what's on the other side?"
He cocked his head and looked at John with his curious, mismatched eyes.
"You do want to know what's on the other side, don't you?"
"Well, it's nothing special," John said. He wanted to ride with Benjen Stark and his rangings deep into the mysteries of the Haunted Forest, wanted to fight Mance Raider's wildlings and ward the realm against the others. But it was better not to speak of the things you wanted. "The rangers say it's just woods and mountains and frozen lakes with lots of snow and ice."
"And the Grumpkins and the Snarks," Tyrion said. "Let us not forget them, Lord Snow, or else what's that big thing for?"
"Don't call me Lord Snow." The dwarf lifted an eyebrow.
"Would you rather be called the Imp? Let them see that their words can cut you, and you'll never be free of the mockery. If they want to give you a name, take it, make it your own. Then they can't hurt you with it any more."
He gestured with his stick.
"Come, walk with me. They'll be serving some vile stew in the common hall by now. I could do with a bowl of something hot."
John was hungry too, so he fell in beside Lannister and slowed his pace to match the dwarf's awkward, waddling steps. The wind was rising, and they could hear the old wooden buildings creaking around them, and in the distance a heavy shutter banging, over and over, forgotten. Once there was a muffled thump as a blanket of snow slid from a roof and landed near them.
"I don't see your wolf," Lannister said as they walked.
"I chain him up in the old stables when we're training. They board all the horses in the east stables now, so no one bothers him. The rest of the time he stays with me. My sleeping cell is in Harden's Tower.
That's the one with the broken battlement, no? Shattered stone in the yard below, and a lean to it, like our noble King Robert after a long night's drinking. I thought all those buildings had been abandoned.
John shrugged. No one cares where you sleep. Most of the old keeps are empty. You can pick any cell you want. Once Castle Black had housed 5,000 fighting men, with all their horses and servants and weapons. Now it was home to a tenth that number, and parts of it were falling into ruin. Tyrion Lannister's laughter steamed in the cold air.
I'll be sure to tell your father to arrest more stonemasons before your tower collapses.
John could taste the mockery there, but there was no denying the truth. The Watch had built 19 great strongholds along the wall, but only 3 were still occupied. East Watch, on its grey, windswept shore, the Shadow Tower, hard by the mountains, where the wall ended, and Castle Black between them at the end of the King's Road. The other keeps, long deserted, were lonely, haunted places, where cold winds whistled through black windows and the spirits of the dead manned the parapets. "It's better than I'm by myself," John said stubbornly. "The rest of them are scared of ghosts."
"Wise boys," Lannister said. Then he changed the subject. "The talk is, your uncle is too long away." John remembered the wish he'd wished in his anger, the vision of Benjen Stark dead in the snow, and he looked away quickly. The dwarf had a way of sensing things, and John did not want him to see the guilt in his eyes. "He said he'd be back by my name day," he admitted. His name day had come and gone unremarked a fortnight past. "They were looking for Sir Waymar Royce. His father is bannerman to Lord Arryn. Uncle Benjen said they might search as far as the Shadow Tower. That's all the way up in the mountains." "I hear that a good many rangers have vanished of late," Lannister said as they mounted the steps to the common hall. He grinned and pulled open the door. "Perhaps the Grumpkins are hungry this year."
Inside, the hall was immense and draughty, even with a fire roaring in the great hearth. Crows nested in the timbers of its lofty ceiling. John heard their cries overhead as he accepted a bowl of stew and a heel of black bread from the day's cooks. Gren and Toad and some of the others were seated at the bench nearest the warmth, laughing and cursing each other in rough voices. John eyed them thoughtfully for a moment. Then he chose a spot at the far end of the hall, well away from the other diners. Tyrion Lannister sat across from him, sniffing at the stew suspiciously.
"Barley, onion, carrot," he murmured. "Someone should tell the cooks that turnip isn't a meat."
"It's mutton stew." John pulled off his gloves and warmed his hands in the steam rising from the bowl. The smell made his mouth water.
"Snow?"
John knew Alistair Thorne's voice, but there was a curious note in it they'd not heard before. He turned.
"The Lord Commander wants to see you, now."
For a moment, John was too frightened to move. Why would the Lord Commander want to see him? They had heard something about Benjen, he thought wildly. He was dead. The vision had come true.
"Is it my uncle?" he blurted. "Is he returned safe?"
"The Lord Commander is not accustomed to waiting," was Sir Alistair's reply, "and I am not accustomed to having my commands questioned by bastards."
Tyrion Lannister swung off the bench and rose.
"Stop it, Thorne, you're frightening the boy."
"Keep out of matters that don't concern you, Lannister. You have no place here."
"I've a place at court, though," the dwarf said, smiling. "A word in the right ear, and you'll die a sour old man before you get another boy to train. Now tell Snow why the old bear needs to see him. Is there news of his uncle?"
"No," Sir Alistair said. "This is another matter entirely. A bird arrived this morning from Winterfell with a message that concerns his brother.
he corrected himself,
his half-brother.
Bran, John breathed, scrambling to his feet. Something happened to Bran? Tyrion Lannister laid a hand on his arm.
John, he said, I'm truly sorry.
John scarcely heard him. He brushed off Tyrion's hand and strode across the hall. He was running by the time he hit the doors. He raced to the commander's keep, dashing through drifts of old snow. When the guards passed him, he took the tower steps two at a time. By the time he burst into the presence of the Lord Commander, his boots were soaked, and John was wild-eyed and panting. "Bran," he said. "What does it say about Bran?" Jorah Mormont, Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, was a gruff old man with an immense bald head and a shaggy grey beard. He had a raven on his arm, and he was feeding it kernels of corn.
I'm told you can read.
He shook the raven off, and it flapped its wings and flew to the window, where it sat watching as Mormont drew a roll of paper from his belt and handed it to John.
"Corn," it muttered in a raucous voice. "Corn! Corn!"
John's finger traced the outline of the dire wolf in the white wax on the broken seal. He recognized Rob's hand, but the letters seemed to blur and run as he tried to read them. He realized he was crying. And then, through the tears, he found the sense in the words and raised his head.
"He woke up," he said. "The cards gave him back."
"Crippled," Mormont said. "I'm sorry, boy. Read the rest of the letter."
He looked at the words, but they didn't matter. Nothing mattered. Bran was going to live.
"My brother is going to live," he told Mormont.
The Lord Commander shook his head, gathered up a fistful of corn and whistled. The raven flew to his shoulder, crying,
"Live! Live!"
John ran down the stairs, a smile on his face and Rob's letter in his hand.
"My brother is going to live," he told the guards.
They exchanged a look. He ran back to the common hall, where he found Tyrion Lannister just finishing his meal. He grabbed the little man under the arms, hoisted him up in the air, and spun him around in a circle.
"Bran is going to live," he whooped.
Lannister looked startled. John put him down and thrust the paper into his hands.
"Here, read it," he said.
Others were gathering around and looking at him curiously. John noticed Gren a few feet away. A thick woolen bandage was wrapped around one hand. He looked anxious and uncomfortable, not menacing at all. John went to him. Gren edged backwards and put up his hands.
"Stay away from me now, you bastard."
John smiled at him. "I'm sorry about your wrist. Rob used the same move on me once, only with a wooden blade. It hurt like seven hells. Yours must be worse. Look, if you want, I'll show you how to defend that." Alistair Thorne overheard him.
"Lord Snow wants to take my place now," he sneered. "Ha! I have an easier time teaching a wolf to juggle than you will training this oryx."
"I'll take that wager, Sir Alistair," John said. "I'd love to see ghost juggle." John heard Gren suck in his breath. Shocked, silence fell. Then Tyrion Lannister, guffawed. Three of the Black Brothers joined in from a nearby table. The laughter spread up and down the benches until even the cooks joined in. The birds stirred in their rafters, and finally even Gren began to chuckle. Sir Alistair never took his eyes from John. As the laughter rolled around him, his face darkened and his sword hand curled into a fist.
"That was a grievous error, Lord Snow," he said at last, in the acid tones of an enemy.
The Drowned Man. Only when his arms and legs were numb from the cold did Aeron Greyjoy struggle back to shore and don his robes again. He had run before the crow's eye as if he were still the weak thing he had been, but when the waves broke over his head they reminded him once more that that man was dead. "I was reborn from the sea, a harder man and stronger." No mortal man could frighten him, no more than the darkness could, nor the bones of his soul, the grey and grisly bones of his soul. The sound of a door opening, the scream of a rusted iron hinge. The priest's robes crackled as he pulled them down, still stiff with salt from their last washing a fortnight past. The wool clung to his wet chest, drinking the brine that ran down from his hair. He filled his waterskin and slung it over his shoulder. As he strode across the strand, a drowned man, returning from a call of nature, stumbled into him in the darkness. "Dampere," he murmured. Aaron laid a hand upon his head, blessed him, and moved on. The ground rose beneath his feet, gently at first, then more steeply. When he felt scrub grass between his toes, he knew that he had left the strand behind. Slowly he climbed, listening to the waves. "The sea is never weary. I must be as tireless." On the crown of the hill, 44 monstrous stone ribs rose from the earth like the trunks of great pale trees. The sight made Aaron's heart beat faster. Naga had been the first sea dragon, the mightiest ever to rise from the waves. She fed on krakens and leviathans and drowned whole islands in her wrath. Yet the Grey King had slain her, and the drowned god had changed her bones to stone, so that men might never cease to wonder at the courage of the first of kings. Naga's ribs became the beams and pillars of his long hall, just as her jaws became his throne. "For 1,007 he reigned here," Aaron recalled. "Here he took his mermaid wife and planned his wars against the storm god. From here he ruled both stone and salt, wearing robes of woven seaweed and a tall, pale crown made from Naga's teeth." But that was in the dawn of days, when mighty men still dwelt on earth and sea. The hall had been warmed by Naga's living fire, which the Grey King had made his thrall. On its walls hung tapestries woven from silver seaweed, most pleasing to the eyes. The Grey King's warriors had feasted on the bounty of the sea at a table in the shape of a great starfish, whilst seated upon thrones carved from mother of pearl. Gone. All the glory gone. Men were smaller now, their lives had grown short. The storm god drowned Naga's fire after the Grey King's death. The chairs and tapestries had been stolen, the roof and walls had rotted away. Even the Grey King's great throne of fangs had been swallowed by the sea. Only Naga's bones endured to remind the Ironborn of all the wonder that had been. "It is enough," thought Aaron Greyjoy. 9 wide steps had been hewn from the stony hilltop. Behind rose the howling hills of Old Wick, with mountains in the distance black and cruel. Aaron paused where the doors once stood, pulled the cork from his waterskin, took a swallow of salt water, and turned to face the sea. "We were born from the sea, and to the sea we must return." Even here he could hear the ceaseless rumble of the waves and feel the power of the god who lurked below the waters. Aaron went to his knees. "You have sent your people to me," he prayed. "They have left their halls and hovels, their castles and their keeps, and come here to Naga's bones, from every fishing village and every hidden vale. Now grant to them the wisdom to know the true king when he stands before them, and the strength to shun the false." All night he prayed, for when the god was in him, Aaron Greyjoy had no need of sleep, no more than the waves did, nor the fishes of the sea. Dark clouds ran before the wind as the first light stole into the world. The black sky went grey as slate, the black sea turned grey-green. The black mountains of Great Wick across the bay put on the blue-green hues of soldier pines. As colour stole back into the world, 100 banners lifted and began to flap. Aaron beheld the silver fish of Botley, the bloody moon of Winch, the dark green trees of Orkwood. He saw warhorns and leviathans and scythes, and everywhere the krakens, great and golden. Beneath them, thralls and saltwives began to move about, stirring coals into new life and gutting fish for the captains and the kings to break their fasts. The dawn light touched the stony strand, and he watched men wake from sleep, throwing aside their sealskin blankets as they called for their first horn of ale. "Drink deep," he thought, "for we have God's work to do today." The sea was stirring too. The waves grew larger as the wind rose, sending plumes of spray to crash against the longships. The drowned god wakes, thought Aeron. He could hear his voice welling from the depths of the sea. I shall be with you here this day, my strong and faithful servant, the voice said. No godless man will sit my sea stone chair. It was there beneath the arch of Naga's ribs that his drowned men found him, standing tall and stern with his long black hair blowing in the wind. Is it time? Rus asked. Aeron gave a nod and said, It is. Go forth and sound the summons. The drowned men took up their driftwood cudgels and began to beat them, one against the other, as they walked back down the hill. Others joined them, and the clangor spread along the strand. Such a fearful clacking and a clattering it made, as if 100 trees were pummeling one another with their limbs. Kettle drums began to beat as well. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. A war horn bellowed, then another. Ow! Men left their fires to make their way toward the bones of the Grey King's Hall. Oarsmen, steersmen, sailmakers, shipwrights, the warriors with their axes and the fishermen with their nets. Some had thralls to serve them, some had salt wives. Others who had sailed too often to the Greenlands were attended by maesters and singers and knights. The common men crowded together in a crescent around the base of the knoll, with the thralls, children, and women toward the rear. The captains and the kings made their way up the slopes. Aeron Damphair saw cheerful Siegfried Stonetree, Andric the Unsmiling, the knight Sir Harris Harlaw. Lord Balor Blacktide in his sable cloak stood beside the stone house in ragged sealskin. Victarion loomed above all of them, save Andric. His brother wore no helm, but elsewise he was all in armor, his kraken cloak hanging golden from his shoulders. He shall be our king. What man could look on him and doubt it? When the Damphair raised his bony hands, the kettle drums and the war horns fell silent, the drowned men lowered their cudgels, and all the voices stilled. Only the sound of the waves pounding remained, a roar. No man could still. We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return, Aeron began softly at first, so men would strain to hear. The storm god in his wrath plucked Balon from his castle and cast him down, yet now he feasts beneath the waves in the drowned god's watery halls. He lifted his eyes to the sky. Balon is dead! The Iron King is dead! The king is dead! His drowned men shouted. Yet what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger, he reminded them. Balon has fallen. Balon, my brother, who honored the old way and paid the iron price. Balon the brave, Balon the blessed, Balon twice crowned, who won us back our freedoms and our god. Balon is dead, but an Iron King shall rise again to sit upon the sea stone chair and rule the isles. A king shall rise, they answered. He shall rise. He shall. He must. Aeron's voice thundered like the waves. But who? Who shall sit in Balon's place? Who shall rule these holy isles? Is he here among us now? The priest spread his hands wide. Who shall be king over us? A seagull screamed back at him. The crowd began to stir, like men waking from a dream. Each man looked at his neighbors to see which of them might presume to claim a crown. The crow's eye was never patient, Aeron Damphair told himself. Mayhaps he will speak first. If so, it would be his undoing. The captains and the kings had come a long way to this feast and would not choose the first dish set before them. They will want to taste and sample, a bite of him, a nibble of the other, until they find the one that suits them best. Euron must have known that as well. He stood with his arms crossed amongst his mutes and monsters. Only the wind and the waves answered Aeron's call. The Ironborn must have a king, the priest insisted. After a long silence, I ask again, who shall be king over us? I will, came the answer from below. At once a ragged cry of, "Gilbert, Gilbert King!" went up. The captains gave way to let the claimant and his champions ascend the hill, to stand at Aeron's side beneath the ribs of Naga. This would-be king was a tall, spare lord with a melancholy visage, his lantern jaw shaved clean. His three champions took up their position 2 steps below him, bearing his sword and shield and banner. They shared a certain look with the tall lord, and Aeron took them for his sons. One unfurled his banner, a great black longship, against a setting sun. "I am Gilbert Farwind, Lord of the Lonely Light," the lord told the Kingsmoot. Aeron knew some Farwinds, a queer folk who held lands on the westernmost shores of Great Wick and the scattered isles beyond, rocks so small that most could support but a single household. Of those, the Lonely Light was the most distant, 8 days' sail to the northwest amongst rookeries of seals and sea lions and the boundless grey oceans. The Farwinds there were even queerer than the rest. Some said they were skin-changers, unholy creatures who could take on the forms of sea lions, walrus, even spotted whales, the wolves of the wild sea. Lord Gilbert began to speak. He told of a wondrous land beyond the sunset sea, a land without winter or want, where death had no dominion. "Make me your king, and I shall lead you there," he cried. "We will build 10,000 ships as Nymeria once did and take sail with all our people to the land beyond the sunset. There every man shall be a king, and every wife a queen." His eyes, Aeron saw, were now grey, now blue, as changeable as the seas. "Mad eyes," he thought, "fool's eyes." The vision he spoke of was doubtless a snare set by the storm god to lure the ironborn to destruction. The offerings that his men spilled out before the Kingsmoot included sealskins and walrus tusks, arm rings made of whalebone, war horns banded in bronze. The captains looked and turned away, leaving lesser men to help themselves to the gifts. When the fool was done talking and his champions began to shout his name, only the Farwinds took up the cry, and not even all of them. Soon enough the cries of, "Gilbert, Gilbert King!" faded away to silence. The gull screamed loudly above them and landed atop one of Naga's ribs as the Lord of the Lonely Light made his way back down the hill. Aeron Dampere stepped forward once more. "I ask again, who shall be king over us?" "Me!" A deep voice boomed, and once more the crowd parted. The speaker was borne up the hill in a carved driftwood chair carried on the shoulders of his grandsons. A great ruin of a man, 20 stones heavy and 90 years old, he was cloaked in a white bearskin. His own hair was snow-white as well, and his huge beard covered him like a blanket from cheeks to thighs, so it was hard to tell where the beard ended and the pelt began. Though his grandsons were great strapping men, they struggled with his weight on the steep stone steps. Before the Grey King's Hall they set him down, and 3 remained below him as his champions. 60 years ago this one might well have won the favor of the Moot, Aeron thought, but his hour is long past. "Aye, me!" the man roared from where he sat, in a voice as huge as he was. "Why not? Who better? I am Eric Ironmaker, for them who's blind. Eric the Just, Eric the Anvil Breaker. Show them my hammer, Thormor." One of his champions lifted it up for all to see. A monstrous thing it was, its haft wrapped in old leather, its head a brick of steel as large as a loaf of bread. "I can't count how many hands I've smashed to pulp with that hammer," Eric said, "but might be some thief could tell you. I can't say how many heads I've crushed against my anvil, neither, but the some widows could. I could tell you all the deeds I've done in battle, but I'm 88 and won't live long enough to finish. If old is wise, no one is wiser than me. If big is strong, no one's stronger. You want a king with heirs? I've more than I can count. King Eric. Aye, I like the sound of that. Come, say it with me. Eric! Eric Anvilbreaker! Eric! King! As his grandsons took up the cry, their own sons came forward with chests upon their shoulders. When they upended them at the base of the stone steps, a torrent of silver, bronze, and steel spilled forth, armrings, collars, daggers, dirks, and throwing axes. A few captains snatched up the choicest items and added their voices to the swelling chant. But no sooner had the cry begun to build than a woman's voice cut through it. Eric! Men moved aside to let her through. With one foot on the lowest step, she said, Eric, stand up. A hush fell. The wind blew, waves broke against the shore. Men murmured in each other's ears. Eric Ironmaker stared down at Usher Greyjoy. Girl. Thrice damned girl. What did you say? Stand up, Eric, she called. Stand up and I'll shout your name with all the rest. Stand up and I'll be the first to follow you. You want a crown? Aye. Stand up and take it. Elsewhere in the press, the crow's eye laughed. Eric glared at him. The big man's hands closed tight around the arms of his driftwood throne. His face went red, then purple. His arms trembled with effort. Aaron could see a thick blue vein pulsing in his neck as he struggled to rise. For a moment, it seemed as though he might do it, but the breath went out of him all at once, and he groaned and sank back onto his cushion. Euron laughed all the louder. The big man hung his head and grew old all in the blink of an eye. His grandsons carried him back down the hill. "Who shall rule the Ironborn?" Aeron Dampere called again. "Who shall be king over us?" Men looked at one another. Some looked at Euron, some at Victarion, a few at Usher. Waves broke green and white against the longships. The gull cried once more, a raucous scream, forlorn. "Make your claim, Victarion," the Merlin called. "Let us have done with this mummer's farce." "When I am ready," Victarion shouted back. Aeron was pleased. "It is better if he waits." The drum came next, another old man, though not so old as Eric. He climbed the hill on his own two legs, and on his hip rode Red Rain, his famous sword, forged of Valyrian steel in the days before the doom. His champions were men of note, his sons, Denys and Donal, both stout fighters, and between them Andric the Unsmiling, a giant of a man with arms as thick as trees. It spoke well of the drum that such a man would stand for him. "Where is it written that our king must be a kraken?" Drum began. "What right has Pike to rule us? Great Wick is the largest isle, Harlaw the richest, Old Wick the most holy. When the Black Line was consumed by dragonfire, the Ironborn gave the primacy to Vicon Greyjoy, aye, but as lord, not king." It was a good beginning. Aeron heard shouts of approval, but they dwindled as the old man began to tell of the glory of the drums. He spoke of Dale the Dread, Rorin the Reaver, the hundred sons of Gormund Drum the Old Father. He drew Red Rain and told them how Hilmar Drum the Cunning had taken the blade from an armored knight with wits and a wooden cudgel. He spoke of ships long lost and battles 800 years forgotten, and the crowd grew restive. He spoke and spoke, and then he spoke still more. And when Drum's chests were thrown open, the captains saw the niggard's gifts he'd brought them. "No throne was ever bought with bronze," the damp hair thought. The truth of that was plain to hear as the cries of "Drum, Drum, Dunstan King" died away. Aeron could feel a tightness in his belly, and it seemed to him that the waves were pounding louder than before. "It is time," he thought. "It is time for Victarion to make his claim." "Who shall be king over us?" the priest cried once more. But this time his fierce black eyes found his brother in the crowd. "9 sons were born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy. One was mightier than all the rest and knew no fear. Victarion met his eyes and nodded. The captains parted before him as he climbed the steps. "Brother, give me blessing," he said when he reached the top. He knelt and bowed his head. Aeron uncorked his waterskin and poured a stream of seawater down upon his brow. "What is dead can never die," the priest said, and Victarion replied, "but rises again, harder and stronger." When Victarion rose, his champions arrayed themselves beneath him. Ralph the Limper, Red Ralph Stonehouse, and Newt the Barber, noted warriors all. Stonehouse bore the Greyjoy banner, the golden kraken on a field as black as the midnight sea. As soon as it unfurled, the captains and the kings began to shout out the Lord Captain's name. Victarion waited till they quieted, then said, "You all know me. If you want sweet words, look elsewhere. I have no singer's tongue. I have an axe, and I have these." He raised his huge mailed hands up to show them, and Newt the Barber displayed his axe, a fearsome piece of steel. "I was a loyal brother," Victarion went on. "When Balon was wed, it was me he sent to Harlord to bring him back his bride. I led his longships into many a battle, and never lost but won. The first time Balon took a crown, it was me sailed into Lannisport to singe the lion's tail. The second time, it was me he sent to skin the young wolf, should he come howling home. All you'll get from me is more of what you got from Balon. That's all I have to say." With that, his champions began to chant, "Victarion, Victarion, Victarion King!" Below, his men were spilling out his chests, a cascade of silver, gold, and gems, a wealth of plunder. Captains scrambled to seize the richest pieces, shouting as they did so, "Victarion, Victarion, Victarion King!" Aeron watched the crow's eye. "Will he speak now, or let the king's moot run its course?" Orcwood of Orcmont was whispering in Euron's ear. But it was not Euron who put an end to the shouting. It was the woman. She put two fingers in her mouth and whistled, a sharp, shrill sound that cut through the tumult like a knife through curds. "Nuncle! Nuncle!" Bending, she snatched up a twisted golden collar and bounded up the steps. Newt seized her by the arm, and for half a heartbeat, Aeron was hopeful that his brother's champions would keep her silent. But Asha wrenched free of the barber's hand and said something to Red Ralph that made him step aside. As she pushed past, the cheering died away. She was Balon Greyjoy's daughter, and the crowd was curious to hear her speak. "It was good of you to bring such gifts to my queensmoot, Nuncle," she told Victarion. "But you need not have worn so much armor. I promise not to hurt you." Asha turned to face the captains. "There's no one braver than my Nuncle. No one stronger. No one fiercer in a fight. And he counts to 10 as quick as any man. I have seen him do it, though when he needs to go to 20, he does take off his boots." That made them laugh. "He has no sons, though. His wives keep dying. The Crow's Eye is his elder and has a better claim." "He does," the Red Oarsman shouted from below. "Ah, but my claim is better still." Asha set the collar on her head at a jaunty angle, so the gold gleamed against her dark hair. "Balon's brother cannot come before Balon's son." "Balon's sons are dead," cried Ralph the Limper. "All I see is Balon's little daughter."
"Daughter?"
Asha slipped a hand beneath her jerkin. "Oh, what's this? Shall I show you? Some of you have not seen one since they weaned you." They laughed again. "Teats on a king are a terrible thing. Is that the song? Ralph, you have me. I am a woman, though not an old woman like you. Ralph the Limper? Shouldn't that be Ralph the Limp?" Asha drew a dirk from between her breasts. "I'm a mother, too. And here's my suckling babe." She held it up. "And here, my champions." They pushed past Victarion's three to stand below her, Carl the Maid, Tristopher Botley, and the knights, Harris Harlaw, whose sword Nightfall was as storied as Dunstan Drum's Red Rain. Mine uncle said you know him. You know me, too. I want to know you better, someone shouted. Go home and know your wife, Usher shot back. Nuncle says he'll give you more of what my father gave you. Well, what was that? Gold and glory, some will say. Freedom, ever sweet. Aye, it's so. He gave us that. And widows, too, as Lord Blacktide will tell you. How many of you had your homes put to the torch when Robert came? How many had a daughter raped and despoiled? Burnt towns and broken castles, my father gave you that. Defeat was what he gave you. Nuncle here will give you more. Not me. What will you give us? Asked Lucas Cod. Knitting? Aye, Lucas. I'll knit us all a kingdom. She tossed her dirk from hand to hand. We need to take a lesson from the young wolf who won every battle and lost all. A wolf is not a kraken, Victorian objected. What the kraken grasps, it does not lose, be it longship or leviathan. And what have we grasped, Nuncle? The north? What is that but leagues and leagues of leagues and leagues, far from the sound of the sea? We have taken Moat Cailin, Deepwood Mott, Torrens Square, even Winterfell. What do we have to show for it? She beckoned, and her black wind men pushed forward, chests of oak and iron on their shoulders. I give you the wealth of the stony shore, Asha said as the first was upended. An avalanche of pebbles clattered forth, cascading down the steps, pebbles grey and black and white worn smooth by the sea. I give you the riches of Deepwood, she said, as the second chest was opened. Pine cones came pouring out to roll and bounce down into the crowd. And last, the gold of Winterfell. From the third chest came yellow turnips, round and hard and big as a man's head. They landed amidst the pebbles and the pine cones. Asha stabbed one with her dirk. Harman Sharp, she shouted. Your son Haddag died at Winterfell for this. She pulled the turnip off her blade and tossed it to him. You have other sons, I think. If you'd trade their lives for turnips, shout my nuncle's name. And if I shout your name, Harmond demanded, what then? Peace, said Asha. Land, victory. I'll give you Sea Dragon Point and the stony shore, black earth and tall trees and stones enough for every younger son to build a hall. We'll have the Northmen, too, as friends to stand with us against the Iron Throne. Your choice is simple. Crown me for peace and victory, or crown my nuncle for more war and more defeat. She sheathed her dirk again. What will you have, Iron Men? Victory! Shouted Roderick the Reader, his hands cupped about his mouth. Victory and Asha! Asha! Lord Baelor Blacktide echoed. Asha Queen! Asha's own crew took up the cry. Asha! Asha! Asha Queen! They stamped their feet and shook their fists and yelled, as the damp hair listened in disbelief. She would leave her father's work undone. Yet Tristopher Botley was shouting for her, with many Harlaws, some good brothers, red-faced Lord Merlin, more men than the priest would ever have believed. For a woman. But others were holding their tongues or muttering asides to their neighbours. No craven's pace, Ralph the Limper roared. Red Ralph Stonehouse swirled the Greyjoy banner and bellowed, Victorian, Victorian, Victorian! Men began to shove at one another. Someone flung a pine cone at Asha's head. When she ducked, her makeshift crown fell off. For a moment, it seemed to the priest as if he stood atop a giant anthill with a thousand ants in a boil at his feet. Shouts of Asha and Victorian surged back and forth, and it seemed as though some savage storm was about to engulf them all. The storm god is amongst us, the priest thought, sowing fury and discord. Sharp as a sword thrust, the sound of a horn split the air. Bright and baneful was its voice, a shivering hot scream that made a man's bones seem to thrum within him. The cry lingered in the damp sea air. Arring! All eyes turned toward the sound. It was one of Euron's mongrels winding the call, a monstrous man with a shaved head. Rings of gold and jade and jet glistened on his arms, and on his broad chest was tattooed some bird of prey, talons, dripping blood. The horn he blew was shiny black and twisted, and taller than a man as he held it with both hands. It was bound about with bands of red gold and dark steel, incised with ancient Valyrian glyphs that seemed to glow redly as the sound swelled. It was a terrible sound, a wail of pain and fury that seemed to burn the ears. Aeron Dampair covered his and prayed for the drowned god to raise a mighty wave and smash the horn to silence. Yet still the shriek went on and on. "It is the horn of hell," he wanted to scream, though no man would have heard him. The cheeks of the tattooed man were so puffed out they looked about to burst, and the muscles in his chest twitched in a way that made it seem as if the bird were about to rip free of his flesh and take wing. And now the glyphs were burning brightly, every line and letter shimmering with white fire. On and on and on the sound went, echoing amongst the howling hills behind them and across the water of Naga's Cradle, to ring against the mountains of Great Wick, on and on and on until it filled the whole wet world. And when it seemed the sound would never end, it did. The hornblower's breath failed at last. He staggered and almost fell. The priest saw Orkward of Orkmont catch him by one arm to hold him up, whilst left-hand Lucas Cod took the twisted black horn from his hands. A thin wisp of smoke was rising from the horn, and the priest saw blood and blisters upon the lips of the man who'd sounded it. The bird on his chest was bleeding too. Euron Greyjoy climbed the hill slowly, with every eye upon him. Above, the gull screamed and screamed again. "No godless man may sit the sea-stone chair," Aeron thought, but he knew that he must let his brother speak. His lips moved silently in prayer. Asha's champions stepped aside, and Victarion's as well. The priest took a step backward and put one hand upon the cold, rough stone of Naga's ribs. The crow's eye stopped atop the steps at the doors of the Grey King's hall and turned his smiling eye upon the captains and the kings, but Aeron could feel his other eye as well, the one that he kept hidden. "Iron men," said Euron Greyjoy, "you have heard my horn. Now hear my words. I am Balon's brother, Kellan's eldest living son. Lord Vicon's blood is in my veins, and the blood of the old Kraken. Yet I have sailed farther than any of them. Only one living Kraken has never known defeat. Only one has never bent his knee. Only one has sailed to Aaschai by the shadow and seen wonders and terrors beyond imagining. If you liked the shadow so well, go back there," called out pink-cheeked Carl the Maid, one of Asha's champions. The crow's eye ignored him. "My little brother would finish Balon's war and claim the north. My sweet niece would give us peace and pine cones." His blue lips twisted in a smile. "Asha prefers victory to defeat. Victarion wants a kingdom, not a few scant yards of earth. From me, you shall have both. Crow's Eye, you call me. Well, who has a keener eye than the crow? After every battle, the crows come in their hundreds and their thousands to feast upon the fallen. A crow can espy death from afar. And I say that all of Westeros is dying. Those who follow me will feast until the end of their days. We are the Ironborn, and once we were conquerors. Our writ ran everywhere the sound of the waves was heard. My brother would have you be content with the cold and dismal north, my niece with even less. But I shall give you Lannisport, High Garden, the Arbor, Old Town, the Riverlands and the Reach, the Kingswood and the Rainwood, Dawn and the Marches, the Mountains of the Moon and the Vale of Arryn, Tarth and the Stepstones. I say we take it all. I say we take Westeros. He glanced at the priest. All for the greater glory of our drowned god, to be sure. For half a heartbeat, even Aeron was swept away by the boldness of his words. The priest had dreamed the same dream when first he'd seen the red comet in the sky. We shall sweep over the green lands with fire and sword, root out the seven gods of the Septons and the white trees of the Northmen. Crozai, Asher called. Did you leave your wits at Ashai? If we cannot hold the north, and we cannot, how can we win the whole of the seven kingdoms? Why, it has been done before. Did Balon teach his girl so little of the ways of war? Victarion, our brother's daughter, has never heard of Aegon the Conqueror, it would seem. Aegon, Victarion crossed his arms against his armored chest. What has the Conqueror to do with us? I know as much of war as you do, Crozai, Asher said. Aegon Targaryen conquered Westeros with dragons. And so shall we, Euron Greyjoy promised. That horn you heard I found amongst the smoking ruins that were Valyria, where no man has dared to walk but me. You heard its call and felt its power. It is a dragon horn bound with bands of red gold and Valyrian steel, graven with enchantments. The dragon lords of old sounded such horns before the doom devoured them. With this horn, iron men, I can bind dragons to my will. Asher laughed aloud. A horn to bind goats to your will would be of more use, Crozai. There are no more dragons. Again, girl, you are wrong. There are three, and I know where to find them. Surely that is worth a driftwood crown. Euron! Shouted left-hand Lucas Cod. Euron, Crozai, Euron! Cried the red oarsman. The mutes and mongrels from the silence threw open Euron's chests and spilled out his gifts before the captains and the kings. Then it was Hotho Harlaw, the priest heard, as he filled his hands with gold. Gorold Goodbrother shouted out as well, and Eric Anvilbreaker. Euron! 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 The cry swelled, became a roar. Euron! Euron! Crozai! Euron! King! It rolled up Naga's Hill like the storm god rattling the clouds. Euron! 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 Even a priest may doubt. Even a prophet may know terror. Aeron Dampare reached within himself for his god and discovered only silence. As a thousand voices shouted out his brother's name, all he could hear was the scream of a rusted iron hinge.
Tyrion. Lord Tywin's chain of hands made a golden glitter against the deep wine velvet of his tunic. The lords Tyrell, Red Wine, and Rowan gathered round him as he entered. He greeted each in turn, spoke a quiet word to Varys, kissed the High Septon's ring and Cersei's cheek, clasped the hand of Grand Maester Pycelle, and seated himself in the king's place at the head of the long table, between his daughter and his brother. Tyrion had claimed Pycelle's old place at the foot, propped up by cushions so he could gaze down the length of the table. Dispossessed, Pycelle had moved up next to Cersei, about as far from the dwarf as he could get without claiming the king's seat. The Grand Maester was a shambling skeleton, leaning heavily on a twisted cane and shaking as he walked, a few white hairs sprouting from his long chicken's neck in place of his once luxuriant white beard. Tyrion gazed at him without remorse. The others had to scramble for seats. Lord Mace Tyrell, a heavy, robust man with curling brown hair and a spade-shaped beard, well salted with white. Paxter Redwine of the Arbor, stoop-shouldered and thin, his bald head fringed with tufts of orange hair. Mathis Rowan, Lord of Gold.